There is one thing our peoples, yours and mine, have in common. Freedom is the air we breathe. Freedom is in our blood and our bones. Freedom, the independence of the human spirit. But we are so used to it that if we ever think of it at all, we think it has dropped into our laps like manna. And unless we look a little beneath the surface, we may feel that we enjoy this freedom because we are better than other people and therefore more worthy of it. Indeed, we may give an impression to the world of that complacent self-righteousness which is said to be one of our most offensive and irritating characteristics. But the truth is that the vast majority of both our peoples have forgotten that this freedom was bought with a great price, that it was obtained by the struggles of generations of those who went before us, by mental wrestlings, by endurance of persecution, by successive failures and triumphs, and we have entered into their labors, the labors of men often far better than ourselves. And if we realize this, how can we imagine that what has been won at such price can be maintained without effort and at no cost to ourselves? Can the lamp by the light of which our ancestors trod their upward path still show us the way unless we keep it trimmed and bright when it is handed to us? Some such thoughts as these have been in our minds in Europe since the Great War. And if they were not in many minds in America, you would never have called this great convention, before which I have the honor of speaking. Now, the questions which you are putting to yourselves are questions which are being asked in all the great democracies of the world. An answer must be found. Have we fallen short of our ideals? What are our ideals? Is democracy safe in the world? What perils face democracy within and without? The peril today from without is plain for the world to see. In Europe, it may be a challenge to the death. But perils from within are common to us all. As I said in Toronto only the other day, ideas are on the wing, and ideas may be a greater peril to democracy than the sword. Only a democracy healthy in body and in every limb can be immune from infection. You and I are probably at one in our ideals, but our problems are different, and the difference is due to certain obvious factors. You live in a vast country. I in a very small one. Our population is homogeneous. Living in an island, we have welded the different peoples who invaded us into a compact whole. And we have had hundreds of years in which to do this with no fresh admixture of alien blood. You are still in process of absorbing millions of your people and of making them into good Americans. People, many of them, to whom freedom was but a name when they first landed on your shores. Our industrial population, wherever it may be concentrated in Great Britain, can be reached at any point in a few hours at the most. Your problem, it seems to me, in many ways is a far harder and more difficult one than ours. Politically, you have a written constitution. We have not. The founders of your constitution, in their wisdom, did all that human skill could devise to protect you from the, shall we say, the abuse of power by a temporary majority. We are dependent on that spirit of give and take, of moderation, that is characteristic of our people. But if once they lose that, if a party majority were ever to play with the idea of forcing on the country their will before the country as a whole approved of that will, we might find ourselves nearer to revolution more quickly than you would. Those are a few of the obvious differences of environment and circumstance between us. And the more clearly we perceive them, the less we shall be disposed to criticize and offer advice to each other. Let us recognize that we both have a great part to play and get on each with our own job at home. Each convinced of the warm sympathy of the other, working for the same great ends, but not necessarily on the same lines. And I have come over to speak to you tonight because I was invited by a representative body of Americans who were good enough to think that I might say something to be of help to this conference at the present time. And I think I can help this great conference best, not by offering advice for which I am not qualified and which indeed would be an impertinence, but by telling you something of my own experiences during the years when I was called upon to guide the destinies of a great democracy through that difficult and critical period immediately following the war. Difficult as our problems are, there are things in common. And my story may give you lines of thought which may be useful to you in adapting them to your own purpose. But as the world is today, great events in one continent have their repercussions in another. No man can live out his life today in a walled garden. in a short address on a subject on which volumes might be written. I may at times sound didactic. That you must forgive. It is the last thing I wish to be, but I have not time in which to qualify and say with each statement, it seems to me. I speak for no one but myself. My public work is finished. Now, it was quite clear in Europe that after the war, we were in a new world. The men at the helm of the various countries were sailing into uncharted seas, and seas not free from fog. Textbooks were of no use. History had to be written as we went along. And it was obvious that industrial history would be written at a speed never approached in its century-old evolution. Democracy itself and government had indeed become the great adventure. I tried, with many others, at least to prepare the way for the new age. And I talked to the people about democracy for 15 years without pause. It was an attempt at that education of democracy, to forward which is now the object of great associations formed of men from all parties on both sides of the Atlantic. No student of history can have any doubt but that democracy is far the most difficult form of government that has ever existed. In a totalitarian state, the citizen has only to do as he is told. He has not to think. He has not to make a choice. No direct responsibility rests on him. The machine is effective so long as he obeys. The success of a democracy depends entirely upon everyone realizing his or her responsibility to it, thinking of his duties and forgetting for a time his rights. If he recognizes no duties towards the form of government to which he is ready enough to pay lip service and to shout for, the day may come when he will lose his rights by dangers from without or from within. That calls for education and character. Education in problems domestic and foreign, so as to have material wherewith to form a judgment, and character to concentrate on the essentials and to look beyond the immediate effect of particular action on the fortunes of any favorite politician. A Democrat should work for and be prepared to die for his democratic ideals as the Nazis and the communists are for theirs. But he will never work for it, much less die for it, unless he is convinced that democracy is capable of making a country worthy of his ideals. And if that Democrat be of British stock, making a country worthy of his spiritual ideals. He may not recognize easily what those ideals are. He certainly cannot exactly express them. But the Bible reading of his ancestors has left so deep a mark upon him that subconsciously he can never embrace a cause that grips his whole being unless he feels in his bones that that cause is morally right. Believing this, I would always stress the spiritual rather than the political foundations of democracy. It is a recognition of the dignity of man and of his individuality. And that dignity and individuality are his as a child of God. There is the unbridgeable gulf between the democracy and the isms that are for the time being in control of so large a part of Europe. But if that be our conviction, with what different eyes we regard our work. Each individual man becomes a human soul with his life to live. And you feel that no work is too hard, no drudgery too dull. If you can do your little bit to make your country a place in which the environment will help him to that end. Differences and honest differences as to how that end is to be accomplished, there will be. There will always be. But with the common purpose, there should be a deep underlying national unity. That is a unity of divine purpose, springing from the people themselves, not imposed, and therefore, in time of stress and strain, infinitely more binding. People thus inspired will be more disposed to recognize their duties. Every free human institution, if it is to be preserved, needs its watchdogs, and no institution more than a democratic government. And the people must realize that one of their greatest responsibilities under a representative system is the choice of candidates and the honor of their representatives. And for the maintenance of that honor, there must be a continuing interest and unsleeping vigilance on the part of the electors. There should be no higher honor than to be a representative of the people. It should be a legitimate object of ambition to the best men in the country, and the position of such men should be respected by the community. Are these things beyond us? I have often thought that many of us are too apt to underrate the quality of the ordinary man. Two things have impressed themselves on me as the result of my own experience as a political leader. One is the extraordinary instinct of our people to see clearly and to make up their minds quickly and surely on a critical issue. I have seen it many times. It does not surprise me, but it fills me with admiration. It makes a man proud to work for such a people. The second thing is their openness to appeals on the highest ground. There are some politicians, as there are some newspaper men, who have a contempt for the ordinary man and think that any garbage is good enough for him. The politician may draw cheers. The newspaper man may make money. But power and influence they will never get by such means. The ordinary man, I've been speaking of my people, but I have a feeling that this applies to you. The ordinary man in the main wants to do the right thing. And if the politician doesn't believe that, he is himself one of the greatest obstacles to the successful working of the democratic system. Now, I spoke a few minutes ago of the perils that face democracy from without and within. These perils are real. They are at our doors. Of these things I have been speaking at home since the early years after the war. I have never addressed an American audience. Probably none of you have read anything I've said, so I have no need to apologize to you for going over some of the ground I have so often covered at home. Ideas are on the wing. Science has brought the nations of the world jostling together, and ideas laugh at boundaries. And there are ideas so loaded with dynamite that they may blow systems that appear founded on a rock into fragments. I need not tell you that such ideas are those of Bolshevism and those propagated by the Nazis and the fascists. No one can foresee what effect they may have on the future of the world, how far they may spread, what their ultimate form may be. But of one thing be clear, they cannot exist within the same boundaries of what you and I understand as democracy.